Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm David LaTulipe with this special broadcast time of Open Air this week in place of Fresh Air just tonight as we were broadcasting the live hearings from NPR and Washington, D.C. of the Kavanaugh hearings this afternoon at 1. Open Air's normal time if you haven't heard us there. A reminder that the shows are archived at KLW.org as well. This week I'll be talking with Greek violinist Leonidas Kavakos, who is in town to perform Stravinsky's Violin Concerto with Michael Tilson Thomas in the San Francisco Symphony during the final weekend of Rebellious Beauty, a Stravinsky festival, which will also feature the scores of Petrushka and The Rite of Spring this weekend. Live music on the way from the virtuosic Iranian musical group The Leon Ensemble. Joy Meads, the new director of dramaturgy for the ACT, joins us in studio to discuss the Pulitzer Prize-winning drama that kicks off the new season, Sweat, by American playwright Lynn Nottage. Plus, Peter Robinson, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, reviews two movies, The Children Act with Emma Thompson and The Wife with Glenn Close, asking the question whether this movie will win her another Oscar, or an Oscar, for that matter. Stay with us. That's music performed live in studio by the Leon Ensemble, the virtuosic Iranian musical group led by Humen Pourmehdi, who you heard there, along with Piraye Purar. And it's led also by Pandit Swapan Chaudhary, who also joins me in studio. They're performing at Z Space this weekend, September 29th and 30th, and they join me in studio to talk about the incredible music that we just heard and to perform a little bit more. It's wonderful to have such live musicians in the studio. And Pandit Swapan Chaudhary, I'm wondering if you could tell me what we just heard.
You know, actually, both Humen and Piraye is a great musician. I mean, of course, they are my friend, but as a musician, they are such a height, you know. It's hard to describe that. But the main thing here is that both Indian music and the Persian music, the root is same, because the whole concept of North Indian classical music actually came after Persian invasion. So there is that root is there. So whenever we play, we find some common ground and we take that and then we try to improvise it and makes kind of a very interesting. And so that's our goal this weekend, to do that. And I'd like to thank Chitras Das Institute, who is putting this concert. They're doing great job. And also Mary, you have done such a wonderful job. So
shout out to Mary Carbonara, the publicist for you. Super. Piraye, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that fascinating instrument that you're playing called the tar.
It's a six strings instrument, tuning pair, and it has 24 to 27 frets, movable frets, and 24, the old version, because old masters, they didn't like to add some of the frets into the music, and then like a sharp and flat, but the new generation, they add three more frets, so we have 27 frets, and the whole we have about two octave and five notes is the tars, actually, when we start from there to bottom, made out of mulberry, and the neck is walnut.
Could you give us an example of the range of sounds, the different types of sounds that instrument's capable of?
Sure. We have 24 intervals in one octave. And so I play from C to C. But since we are tuning like half a step below, it's actually B to B.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But this is my movable do. And then this is one octave.
And you were just playing on one string, to be clear for that, right?
Yeah.
And then how are they used in combination?
The combination.
Always with this, I wish we could see this visually on the radio. It's very difficult to explain. But your fingers are always moving in the same way on the frets. You're not in different positions.
Actually, it is. But because I want to go one interval at the same time, I'm just using one. But you know, normally I'm using the whole fingers.
So of the six strings, sometimes you're just playing one. Sometimes you're playing a combination of
exactly.
The six.
Yeah. And sometimes I use the like a chords. Even on one string, C and E.
It's almost like an American banjo sound in terms of the tuning.
I've heard that many times.
I'm wondering what there might be a connection. There might be some doctoral dissertation in that from somebody. That's Piraye Purar demonstrating the tar. Also, you heard on that earlier performance, Humen Pourmehdi, who's playing the drums. What sort of drums were you playing there, so people know what we were hearing?
Actually, the drum that I just played, it's a kind of frame drum. The reason I played the frame drum, because we wanted to play a little softer to start. But my original frame drum, which I have it here, is called DAF, D-A-F. It's kind of wild instrument, and I'll play later on. But this is an American-made frame drum. It's a modified frame drum from, you know, East, and a tunable drum, actually.
Mm-hmm. Show us some examples of what you can do with that drum.
Well, there's many, many possibilities. You know, there's many positions that we play with this drum.
Let's just explain it, first of all. The diameter is about, what, 18 inches?
Right.
And it's about 5 inches deep?
Yeah.
And a single head.
Yeah, we have a synthetic skin. So there's many possibilities in this drum. And different size, of course, you know. We play a combination, you know, together, tunable.
Fantastic. That's fantastic. I'd like to ask Pandit to talk a little bit more about the differences between North Indian and South Indian music.
North and South?
Yeah.
The South Indian music is more conservative music. I mean, conservative in the sense because South India was not invaded by Persian.
Mm-hmm.
So they used to hold that as their, as if it is the original music. So in that way, it is little different. And their rhythm section is very different because they always go, which is called Jati system, which means like three, four, five, seven, and nine. And so all the rhythmic structure they will do, they will take it out from that section. But North Indian music, whenever the rhythm section comes, it is very fixed. The rhythm, is fixed. You cannot change it. Means that if it is 16 beats rhythm cycle, you cannot change it according to Jati, that what South Indian system does. But I think, in my opinion, both the systems are fantastic. They mm-hmm. have such a huge range. And I think that's the main difference between South and North.
Okay,
about
and so
the rhythm.
Then let's talk specifically about what Persian influences went into Northern Indian music specifically.
Persian invasion, after that influence, what happened, that overall changes from, say, what I just said about the Jati system to a fixed note, fixed rhythm section came, and also influenced a lot about Sufi music during that time. Sufism came during that time, in 13th century. And that kind of changed the name of the melody, you know, that which we call raga. So, and also the concept of thalas, which is the rhythm cycle, also influenced by the Persian invasion, which was not in South.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so the music that will be performed as part of this weekend's concerts are concentrating on the Persian influence into the northern music. Talking with Pandit Swapan Chowdhury, with instrumentalists Human Pourmehdi and Pirya Purafar, who is playing tar. Could you folks offer us some more music that will be heard this weekend? What would you like to play? And,
sure,
and if you could give us an explanation of what the music is. And
We're improvising right now. I'm just being improvising. So I might, since Swapanda is talking about the influence of Sufi music, and I have this instrument called daf, which is the main drumming, main drum in the Sufi music. And before we start, I have to say that we are so humbled to play with Swapanda Chowdhury. It's amazing concert, amazing time we're gonna have together. And I've been looking, forward to this concert for years. And even though we play together a lot, but this time is different. It's such a pleasure to have, he led us to play with him.
Oh,
so that is
lovely.
What I see it.
That's
it's
a very nice tribute.
So humble.
So will improvisation have a big factor in quite a bit this weekend?
There is fixed composition and improvisation happening. Both together, because improvisation in Persian music is very important. once you learn the Persian music and you kind of figured it out, we have to leave everything behind and then we have to improvise.
Mm.
So not many people can go through that stage to pass it. So because what we hear improvisation, sometimes we're hearing the repeating of the repertoire of Persian music, but the pure improvisation is the core of Persian classical music, that basically based on what we feel in this moment, that right now it is, and which based on the idea of Sufism, that we pressure the moment that we are right now. We don't think about the past and future, so the moment is precious.
Suman Pour Mehdi, who is a master percussionist, musician, and composer, has been a key contributor to popularizing Iranian music here in the U.S., performing throughout the world in a variety of venues. What would you like to play for us now?
We'll see. I don't know if we play something.
Virya, you have something in mind?
Actually, let's play one of the songs that we're going to perform in the concert.
Super.
So people can, you know, have better understanding of what they have, you know, anticipate or accept to, you know, lessen or whatever.
Please.
Is based on Rumi's poetry and is Suman Pour Mehdi's composition. And the good thing is that Saturday is Rumi's birthday as well.
Ah, very nice.
Yeah. And so we celebrate Rumi's birthday on Saturday.
Leon Ensemble, Piria Porafar on tar, and Human Pourmehdi on drums. They're being presented at the invitation of master living tabla virtuoso Pandit Swapan Chaudhuri as part of the Chitrish Dash Institute's Noor, The Path of Light, a world premiere musical and cultural collaboration between masters Pandit Swapan Chaudhuri and the Human Pourmehdi and the Alliance Ensemble. It's this Saturday and Sunday at Z Space in San Francisco. For more information, visit zspace.org. Thank you all so much for coming in and sharing your incredible talents with us.
Thank you for having us.
Also, we have to mention we have a real singer. Mr. Ariza Shah Mohammadi is also going to join us, and also our Kamanche player Mani Buluri is going to join us. He's a complete ensemble, so of course Swapanda is going to be the highlight for our concert.
It sounds amazing.
And also joining with us Nilan Chaudhary, my son on tabla, and Raginder Amomi, a violin player.
Fantastic. Thanks again for coming in.
And also, sorry.
No,
sorry.
Please. Got to get it.
The first part will be very interesting youth dancer, Kathak dancer.
Thanks for mentioning that. Zspace.org for more information. Should be a fantastic couple of evenings of music. Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
ACT is staging the Pulitzer Prize winning drama from 2017 of Lynn Nottage, Sweat, through October 21st. It's a play that's set in Reading, Pennsylvania, the blue-collar heart of America's steel industry. A tight-knit group of factory workers has gathered in a local bar for generations to share laughs, hopes, and, of course, cold beers. But as the country heads into a new millennium, recession looms, a union lockout turns assembly line into picket line, pitting them against each other in the struggle to survive. It's inspired by true stories of Rust Belt workers, and Lynn Nottage goes, quote, where few playwrights have dared to go, according to Variety, to forge a searing drama of the grit, drive, and resilience of our conflicted American dreams. Here to talk about the play is the recently appointed Director of Dramaturgy and New Works, Joy Meads. She's a native of Oakland, and she's back now in the Bay Area from a stint at Center Stage Theater Group in Los Angeles, where she's wrapping up her tenure as literary manager and an artistic engagement strategist. Joy was literary manager at Steppenwolf Theater and associate artistic director at California Shakes. She has also developed plays with, among others, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Berkeley Rep, the Denver Center for the Performing Arts, the O'Neill, Ojai Playwrights Conference, Portland Stage, and many others. Joy is also a proud member and co-founder of the Kilroys, who are called the superheroines of the theater by Backstage. The Kilroys are a gang of playwrights and dramaturgs working for gender parity on American stages. Joy, a very fine welcome to you. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And welcome back to the Bay Area.
It's great to be home.
I'm sure it is. Well, you know, for people that aren't familiar with the world of theater, what exactly does a dramaturg do?
Great. So a dramaturg is a kind of textual expert on the play. We serve a variety of functions. It's a little different on every project. But some of the things I'll do is I'll do research on the world of the play to provide context for the actors. And I'll give them an actor packet. I'll also be another set of eyes for the director. And on a new play, I would be in conversation with the playwright to make sure that they are realizing their intentions for the play, giving them feedback, working with them maybe in a way that's analogous to an editor working with a novelist.
And for this particular production, what was your involvement with?
So I was Betty.
I mean, you might be too new to the equation.
With Sweat, I was present in rehearsals. I got to experience this extraordinary company working together to find the truths of the play. I did a ton of research. I think we had a 160-page actor packet into things like what is a union lockout and what does it feel to be locked out from factory work? What are the psychological effects of unemployment? What's happening with the opioid crisis, and why are people turning to opioids in numbers greater than ever before? So I'm really helping give the ensemble some context to understand the experience of these characters in these plays.
It's interesting. The New York Times has called this the first work from a major American playwright to summon with empathy and without judgment the nationwide anxiety that helped put Donald J. Trump in the White House.
You know, I think this play is in a perfect example of why we need artists in the world. Lynn Nottage spent 2 years going to Reading, Pennsylvania between 2012 and 2014, and she interviewed everyone that she could think of, you know, and talked to them about what those years have been like. And then she wrote this play that I think shows us, it distills everything that she heard and really helps us understand the moment of time that we are in and what got us to this moment. I think that this is a play to see if you want to understand what's happening in America today. I think it's a play to read if you love great American dramas. You know, I think it's a little similar actually to Death of the Salesman. I think it's one of those major works that students will be reading in 50 years, not only to understand enduring truths about, you know, the human experience, but also to understand what it meant to be alive in this time and place.
Interesting. And how was this cast assembled? This is coming to us from another production, or is this is all originated here in San Francisco?
It's all originated here in San Francisco, yeah. And it's an extraordinary cast put together by our casting director, Janet Foster, with our director, Loretta Greco. Mm-hmm. And they're amazing. I mean, it's just such a pleasure to see the way that this play is alive every night, because we have just an extraordinary caliber of actors. It's a little different every moment. It's live theater.
Mm-hmm. It's running through the 21st at the Geary Theater, ACT's mothership, so to speak.
Yes.
So what are things that you're looking forward to as you begin your tenure as dramaturge?
Well, I'm really excited to be part of an incredible team at ACT under the leadership of Pam McKinnon, the new artistic director, and Jennifer Bielstein, our new executive director. You know, I think this is a really exciting moment in the history of the theater. I knew Pam before I came here. I worked with her on a workshop of a play and a production of a revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf at Steppenwolf a few years back. And so I got to see what a brilliant artist and leader she is. So I'm really excited about joining with her and to see, you know, to in this new tenure and to investigate how we are having the most exciting and dynamic conversation between classics and new works, you know, on our stages.
Mm-hmm. And I wish you a wonderful tenure as part of your return to the
Thank
Bay
you.
Area. Congratulations on that.
Thanks.
ACT presents the Pulitzer Prize winning drama Sweat by Lynn Nottage from 2017, a timely tale that does delve into the grit, drive, and resilience of our conflicted American dreams. It's at ACT's Geary Theater through the 21st of October. Information at act-sf.org. Thanks so much for coming in today, Joy. We'll have you again to talk about other productions that are down the pike for ACT.
I'd love to come back. Thanks.
You're quite welcome. Well, the San Francisco Symphony gave a Stravinsky Festival back in 1999. Michael Tilson Thomas decided to do one once again before he ends his tenure as music director next year. These concerts have featured the wonderful works of Igor Stravinsky, and this weekend feature Petrushka, The Rite of Spring, as well as the Stravinsky Violin Concerto with soloist Leonidas Kavakos. Quite a guy. I caught up with him the other day at Davies Symphony Hall. Here's that conversation. Leonidas, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here with you.
Well, as you know, Michael Tilson Thomas has some special insights into Stravinsky. This was just the first rehearsal. I'm wondering if he offered any of those insights to you as you've been working on the piece.
Well, we actually rehearsed a bit before starting the orchestra rehearsal. So we kind of, you know, you just find a way by exchanging ideas and so on. But it helps, of course, when one is rehearsing with the orchestra, when you can hear actually what's coming from you know, both sides, and then how one can find the way, the common way. Mm-hmm. I think it's coming very nicely, and there'll be quite a bit of sparkle there.
Well, there's a wonderful story about the creation of this piece and Stravinsky's famous chord that opens in some way or another each of the four movements, and him sketching it on a napkin and asking the gentleman who was helping him advise about the violin, Samuel Dushkin, is this going to be possible? And he said, no, it's not going to be possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, it's a wonderful story, but what is really even more wonderful is the imagination of Stravinsky, which, of course, with practically every piece he wrote, he managed to challenge anybody that would ever be involved. And those times when these pieces were performed and heard for the first time, you know, I can only imagine what it must have been like. For instance, one can hear the recording of Stravinsky with Dushkin playing this piece for the first time in Berlin, and it's what a mess. You know, the orchestra is like they're struggling to play these complicated rhythms that are throwing off everybody each time. It's like you try to walk on something on the surface that is moving all the time, and you never know where actually is a solid place to put your foot on. And it only shows up at the very last moment, and then you just have to make it, and it's challenging like crazy. But, you know, as I said, Stravinsky had this amazing imagination and possibility and talent to surprise, and therefore that chord also is a chord that is practically is like a grimace. It's like a ugly face. It's like somebody who is reacting to something he cannot believe or something. So it's something that goes over the boundaries, and that's why he had to ask. Probably he had heard that mostly the 10th is the biggest, more or less, interval that one can play on the violin in the traditional, so to say, technique. And that, of course, is one step further. So it's like 11 notes apart, and it demands an effort to reach that chord. It's a big extension for the hand. Mm-hmm. And he just wanted to know whether that is possible. And it's funny, not so much in the first and the last movement, but in the two middle movements, where the rest of the music is not as rhythmical or as humorous or as funny and as
jagged.
Yeah, there you have this enormous contrast between the atmosphere that the chord creates and then what happens right after, which is many times very lyrical, especially in the second aria, which is touches, I think, the border of, as a colleague said, neo-baroque in a way. So it's practically like Bach. Of course, we know that he loved the violin concerto, the double violin concerto, and there is very much of that music there, the ornaments as we hear them in the Baroque music. But the support of the orchestra is not so atonal. It's quite more, so to say, smooth, and therefore when that chords come back, the first couple of bars with this very strong and aggressive sound, it's enormous shock. So it's, you know, it was as he called it, his passport to the whole piece. Mm-hmm. and that is very, of course, obvious. But also I think again what he managed to do, not only with that chord but with the rest of the music that he gave to the violin repertoire, an amazing, amazing composition.
Well, you mentioned the jagged rhythms and the jumps that we normally associate with Stravinsky, and then again in these two arias, absolutely beautiful, beautiful melodies that he creates. Could I trouble you just to play a little bit of that second aria, the slow movement?
Yeah. So we have this. So once So we see all this ornamentation that goes on around the main notes, which we see very much in Bach practically, and in music of that era. But what he manages to do with the orchestration and the harmonies that support and surround this melody is really, one has to say, is amazing, because it's not romantic, yet is very meaningful, very it doesn't create this kind of strong emotions, but it has an ethereal quality.
Almost like a melancholy.
Yeah, but it's like with Bach, you know, that you have this incredible, you feel totally complete about what you're receiving as a listener.
Well, tell us about this incredible instrument that you're playing, a genuine Stradivarius. You must have to be especially very protective of it. A lot of times with these instruments such as the Strads and the Guarneriuses, they're owned by a private collector or an institution that then loans it to the soloist. What is the story of your Stradivarius?
Well, I go back with this violin a long time. When I got my first Strad back in 1995, that was during a time where there was this incredible exhibit of Guarneri instruments in the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and I was invited there to play. There was going to be a concert with the instruments exhibited, and I was invited to play together with three other colleagues in this concert. So I was there, and it happened that very time was the time when I got my very first Strad violin, built in 1692, quite an early one, and I was totally overwhelmed and very happy about it. And it was a very funny coincidence where the man who then owned this violin that I'm playing now, he had already two of his Guarneris exhibited in the museum, and we went to dinner with some friends and so on, and he showed up, and everybody told me, you know, that he has also a fantastic Stradivari violin. I said, oh great, I would love to see it. And then he took out, it was this instrument, and that I have now today, and I tried a couple of notes on it, and I was totally shocked. I remember the feeling, because it's amazing when you are already very happy about something, you think, you know, this is really fantastic, and then right at that moment you meet something that is more overwhelming than what you already have, and this is just almost too much. And so that was the effect that it had on me. I said, my God, how is that possible? Something sounds like this. But of course the instrument was not available at the moment, and it was just an incredible experience to try it for a few minutes and then give it back. But I never forgot it somehow, and that is 2 years ago. I was in London playing, and I have a very good friend who's a dealer there, Florian Leonard, and I always visit him because he has always lots of wonderful instruments. And so I went there, and we started talking violins and so on, and all of a sudden I saw that instrument lying on the table, and I thought, well, it cannot be. Because I remember instruments very well, because they are like human faces, you know, when you're interested you don't forget. And so at the moment I'm staring at the violin from far, and then Florian says, oh, you know, this is a great violin we have here. I said, if I think this is what it is, I know it very well. I told him. He says, oh really? I said, yes. I go close and I see this one there, and I just could not believe my eyes. After 25 years, whatever it was, the violin was lying right there in front of me. I said, my God, I know this violin. I remember it for so many years. It has stayed in my ears, you know, how amazing, what an amazing sound it has. Anyway, by the way, but I'm sure it's not available, right? He said, no, it is. And so, as they say, I moved earth and sky trying to get it, you know, to my hands. So I'm very happy that I had and lucky that I had the opportunity to give my old one back. Mm-hmm. And
so it's all yours?
Yes, and get this one.
Wow.
So I'm really a happy man. And it's an instrument that is made in 1734. It's called the Wilmot. And Wilmot was a Belgian violinist who started a career, but then he stopped it. He married a woman that was very much in love with him, and she forced him to choose between her or a career. He decided to go for her. But he was very lucky because her father was the owner of the Antwerp port. So he had an enormous financial status, as you can imagine. And with that help, he managed to own no less than 19 Stradivari violins in his life. And this is one of them. This is a very late violin, the Stradivari built when he was 90 years old. And it's one of these few examples which he built without the assistance of his sons. Not that they were not good enough, but still, when the old man was building something exclusively with his own hands, then that, of course, you can imagine the experience, the talent, the genius, the knowledge, all going there without any interference, that's something significant. And so I'm very, very fortunate to have that violin, which helps me enormously to express colors and nuances, but also have enough power to be able to feel comfortable still when you have a big orchestra behind.
I was going to ask you, you also own several modern instruments. Mm-hmm. What are the determining factors for what violin you use for what work or what situation?
Well, I mostly use the Stradivarius. The violins is like...
When you can drive a Cadillac, you drive a Cadillac.
It's not about that. It's just that the modern making is fantastic nowadays. It's just that all violins, even the Stradivari violins, they needed time. They need to be played. They need to be explored. They need to be challenged. And they need to grow. We have letters from very famous violinists of the time when the Stradivarius violins were like 60, 70 years old. And who tell that they prefer the Amati violins at the time because they were much more mature than the Stradivari. It is something very normal. So the problem is that, of course, at this point, back-to-back, any modern violin, although it might be as powerful, it won't be as inspiring. That is for sure. Of course, people can get used to it and just... You have people playing modern violins and having wonderful careers. That's absolutely fine. But my experience with modern violins is that you see, when you play a modern violin, you see it as a challenge for the instrument and also for the player, because it's not going to give you what an old instrument is going to give you. Mm. It doesn't have that, you know, it hasn't had that kind of, how can I say it? It's like a human being growing, you know, when you are 20, you know much more than when you're 10 years old. When you're 30, you know more than you're 20, and it goes on like this.
Something in the DNA of the actual violin, so to speak.
Yeah, well, the thing is that we will never know, of course, how it will be. We know from the other makers that are contemporary with Stradivarius that they just could not match that kind of quality. We don't know yet whether the violin makers of the 19th century will match that. We still have another 100 years to know how they're going to develop. And for the violins of the 20th century, that's even more of a wait. Mm-hmm. So, but that doesn't mean that one should not be playing those instruments. And
although I think the carbon fibers will never quite match.
No, I think that is something that could be seen as a curiosity or something like, you know, something fun to do or strange to do or eccentric or bizarre or something like this, but I don't think it is going to be ever something that's going to be taken seriously when we're really talking about the very subtle elements of sound making.
Mm-hmm. You'll be touring with the San Francisco Symphony right after these concerts with this concerto, including a return to Carnegie Hall. It must be something of a luxury to do this work multiple times with the same orchestra and with the same conductor.
Oh, totally. Totally. This is one great thing about orchestras here in America, where the subscription weeks offer three opportunities normally, and sometimes four, to perform the same repertoire, which means you have the couple of days of rehearsals to bring it to a certain point, the interpretation, and then you have three chances without rehearsing, just by the stage feeling and by what one has talked about and created in the rehearsals, to take it even further. And I remember when I studied with Gingold in Indiana, he told me that the biggest teacher is a stage. So actually what happens during a performance is something that is always imprinted on the mind. And you can practice months and years. It's great. But the concentration and the adrenaline of the stage, of the concert on stage, is something that is not, cannot be practiced, cannot be prepared. So it's a different level of knowledge and of achievement. And I think that's what he meant. And therefore, when one has the opportunity to perform several times, that gives really a possibility to arrive to an amazing point of, you know, it's a combination. Then one starts feeling more comfortable, more confident, and then one frees up with the expression. And that then serves better the music, you know, because we have to be also, stage is sometimes, and not sometimes, you have to be also very careful, because it's very sensitive and very, the ensemble is very something that's very elegant. So everybody is listening to everybody, and everybody's very fragile. So when we start sailing together, and then we understand that the wind is at the right direction, and we can somehow feel confident that nothing we have to worry about, and the sails are not going to go the other side and hit us all in the head or something, whatever, then that already...
Even though on tour you'll be in different boats, so to speak, in different concert halls.
Yeah, we are in different concert halls, but there's always the rehearsals, the sound checks, and but I'm talking about the feeling on stage, which is something that is developing in a way that... that it creates all, gives all these elements what I mentioned before, the confidence, the freedom and the security. And so one really then starts focusing more and more into shaping the colors and coloring actually the interpretation and the music. And that is what we're looking for from the very first moment. It's just that we have to first go to the first couple of steps. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned so many things going on. You're very busy on the chamber music front, just back from a tour with Emmanuel Ax and Yo-Yo Ma, your frequent collaborators, soloist and concerti all over the world, and a great deal of conducting, a very rich musical life. Is a music directorship something you're eventually looking forward to and settling down for?
Not at the moment, no.
Perhaps down the road.
For I don't know, you know, I don't have a plan in this sense. I don't have an ambition, and I don't have a plan, a career plan. My plan is totally artistic. There are certain orchestras that I've already built a relation with as a conductor, and I go back to them regularly.
Well, you know, there'll be an opening here in a couple of years.
As I said, I have no... look, playing is something that takes enormous amount of devotion, and if one wants to do it seriously, one cannot do something else that requires equal devotion, which is the music.
Well, you're certainly contributing a great deal to the interpretation of Stravinsky. We look forward to these performances, and chant us again in January when you come back.
With great pleasure. It's always, San Francisco is a great place to be from many, many different perspectives, and I'm always very happy when I'm here, and especially when I have the chance to work with this wonderful orchestra and MTT.
Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
The Stravinsky Festival continues with concerts tonight through Sunday. The San Francisco Symphony under the baton of Michael Tilson Thomas. Leonidas Kavakos is soloist for the violin concerto, which the symphony also tours with in the weeks ahead. Also on the program, Petrushka, and the Rite of Spring. Information at sfsymphony.org. A pleasure to welcome back Peter Robinson for a brief time to talk about movies. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be here.
And two leading ladies of the cinema.
That's right, ladies of the cinema. And also, we're actually going from high drama in Washington to what I call high drama on the silver screen. And in this case, as you've mentioned, two very powerful women playing very powerful roles. So the two movies in question, the first is The Wife, with Glenn Close, and then the second is The Children Act with Emma Thompson. So I'm going to start with The Wife, which is an intriguing story about literally the wife of a prize-winning, Nobel Prize-winning novelist and how that relationship develops. So this is really a movie which will appeal to people who enjoy the act of writing, readers who enjoy the act of reading, and publishers who, in a certain sense, enjoy the act of publishing. But it's a movie loaded with lots of twists, and I think it really approaches what is the role of the female writer, where does she stand in relation to the male husband, the Nobel Prize winner, and then there are minor cameo performances by Elizabeth McGovern, who we may remember from Downton Abbey, and she is playing a very interesting cameo part of an embittered minor author. I highly recommend this for anybody who has dipped their nose in a book, because it gets you to think about to what extent in the 1980s, 1990s was publishing very much still a man's world, and how does a woman cope under those conditions? So when I say it's timely, this, I think, may be the performance of a lifetime for Glenn Close. This may be the year that she actually gets the Oscar. But it's also a send-up, a little bit of the Swedes, how Nobel Prizes are given. And throughout the story, some of the minor characters, one in particular, a journalist known as Bone, played by Christian Slater, shows to what extent journalists go to get the snippets for doing a biography. So the movie is running around town. It's called The Wife. It stars Glenn Close as the wife, and Jonathan Pryce turns in a great performance as the husband. Yep. Highly recommended.
Also mentioned Christian Slater, also Elizabeth McGovern among the cast.
She is in there, yeah. Now, very different movie. You can get it on Amazon, but it will be getting released in the next month. It's called The Children's Act, and it stars Emma Thompson. So she is now back in the hot seat on the silver screen, and she is playing the role of a high court judge in the family division on the British legal system. And she turns in, I think, just an excellent performance. It's based on the novel of the same title by Ian McEwan. And in the opening case, it presents a moral dilemma. A 17-year-old Jehovah's Witness boy, and he is 17, is in hospital. The hospital are petitioning to give him a blood transfusion, and that, of course, is against the religion. So you move into a moral story about the meaning of life and the life-saving devices. You're dealing with medicine, but at the same time, the main character, Emma Thompson, has marital problems on her hand. And I think, again, this is one of these interesting stories which evolves a story about couples, particularly couples where they've each got a claim to their own lives, but things are getting in the way. So if you like Ian McEwan as a novelist, I think they've done a good job taking the words off the page and turning it into a lively, thinking person's movie. I call these both The Wife and The Children Act adult pictures. And I use that in the best sense. There are no car chases, no harem scarum, no explosions, but down-to-earth good storytelling. And timely, because people of the Me Too generation and the Me Too movement will find some deep insights about the status of women and where we are today. So if you want high drama in Washington, go to the hearings. If you want high drama on the silver screen, two great recommendations here, The Wife and The Children's Act.
Thank you so much, Peter, for your insight and your recommendations, as always, are welcome here on Open Air. You've been listening to Open Air at its special time this week only, 6 p.m., and because of the Kavanaugh hearings that took place at Open Air's normal time of 1 in the afternoon. That's when you can hear Open Air on a regular basis, Thursday afternoons at 1. It's KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm David LaTulip, your host for the program. The shows are archived at KALW.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show and my guests for taking the time for trekking to the KLW studios, including that wonderful live performance from the Leon Ensemble. Links to all of the guests are at the Open Air page at KALW.org. If you've got a program suggestion, a segment suggestion that you'd like to hear more of and given some time on the air, by all means, send me an email. I'm David@KALW.org. Fresh Air will return at its normal time next Thursday at 6. Thanks for listening. KALW is a media sponsor for the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, which invites you to a conversation with Nadia Tolokonnikova, the Russian conceptual artist, political activist, and founder of Pussy Riot, will discuss her new book and talk about making political action exciting and joyful. Wednesday, October 10th at 7 p.m. Information at jccsf.org/arts.